sticking out for this last part of the conference. And I'm going to apologize because if you attended the BT monitoring program on Wednesday morning, you're going to see a lot of the same data. So if you want to sleep, that's fine. All right, so essentially what I'm going to do is go over our survey data that we have, and I'm just going to cover Texas and the Mid-South in this presentation. Dominic's part of our group, and he's collected a great deal of data over and on the eastern side of the U.S., and Dr. Greg Payne as well. I'm going to be presenting data primarily from our lab at Texas A&M and Nathan Littles with USDA at Stoneville. And it's going to it kind of dovetails in a lot with what Dominic talked about. I mean, the bioassay procedure is similar to what he described. It's just a diet overlay looking at a variety of toxins, in this case, Cry1AC, Cry2AB2, Cry1F, and the VIP3A. So we're covering the basis for the technology we see in cotton. And these bioassays are going to have 6 to 8 different concentrations, and we're going to be replicating these over 4 times. We rate mortality after 7 days. They're infested as neonates, and then 7 days you read mortality. We're counting everything that is either actually dead or still a first instar is dead. And from this, we're going to develop resistance ratios based on a comparison to a known susceptible. And we have a couple of susceptible strains we work with. The primary one is we call the Benzon strain, and we get it from Benzon. So when we look at Texas, and this is the Cry1AC data from this last year. And you know, we've done this for a number of years. And I think what we can pretty much say is resistance to Cry1AC appears to be quite high. And from the data we collected in Texas this year, we're running almost 86% of the collections testing positive for resistance. And what we're calling resistance here is anything that runs a resistance ratio of tenfold or higher. And so, and you can see some of our resistance ratios are quite high, well over 900. When we get into the Mid-South, and I'm going to break this up because we have a lot of data that Nathan Little collected out of Mississippi. But again, very high numbers coming out of the Mid-South. And I should point this out, that the susceptible strains are those that are in the black boxes. The field strains are those in the grayer boxes. You'll see, I put the data in for both labs, Nathan's and mine, and I'm separating those just in case there's any slight differences between our results and our lab. But again, 100% of the populations from these three states, Tennessee, Arkansas, and Louisiana, and 100% from all the collections in Mississippi, all came back as positive for greater than tenfold resistance. But keep in mind, I mean, Cry1AC's never been just a stellar toxin on bollworm, right? So it's all, and we've always had a lot of variability, but I think we've reached a point where it's fairly, I think we can categorize it now as ineffective. I'm going to show, also we have data on what procedure we call, it's an F2 screen, and I'm not going to go into the nuts and bolts of this procedure. Actually, we thought Dr. Yang, who's after me, was going to go first, and he's supposed to set this up, so we kind of got these reversed. But on an F2 screen, it's a means of finding resistant alleles in populations. And we did a lot of screening in Texas, and in, again, this is some Mid-South data. And looking at the number of families that we collected from this screen, 93% of them appear to be carrying resistant. The resistant families. So again, it's very comparable to what we're seeing with our field monitoring data. Cry1F, we don't have a lot of data on it, but it's again, it's not a toxin that's really known to be very stellar on Zaya. And by and large, they all tend to be testing resistant to that toxin. So that's the other one, in like wide strike. So like your old wide strike, Cry1AC, Cry1F, that's both their toxins. And that's why they're no longer wanting to sell wide strike. And again, here's a couple more from the Mid-South for Cry1F, 100% resistance. Now getting into Cry2s, this for Texas, Cry2AB2, and it's a little bit nicer pitcher. It's not great, but it is a little bit nicer. From the collections we have this last year, we're running about 57% of those testing resistant to the Cry2. So that's the second toxin that's in your Bogard. It's the second. It's very similar to the second toxin you'll see in TwinLink. So they're gonna have the essentially the same mode of action. Going into the Mid-South, out of Tennessee, Arkansas, and Louisiana, we only had one collection out of Louisiana that came back as testing susceptible. And then if we look in Mississippi, it's a similar. A lot of populations tested, and only one coming back is susceptible. So we put all these together for the Mid-South, we're running almost 80%. And so that's higher than what we were even seeing in Texas. And again, going back to the F2 screen data, what we're seeing with the F2 screens is that we're seeing 39% of the populations or the families that we develop coming back as resistant using a discriminating dose. That's a pretty high discriminating dose. And before I pass off on this particular, you know, we've done some characterizations for the resistance to Cry1AC and Cry2AB2. The Cry1AC appears to be a dominant gene. The Cry2AB2 is a very confusing situation. It looks like it's polygenic, and it also can be incompletely dominant or incompletely recessive. I mean, it almost just runs straight down the middle between partially recessive or incompletely dominant. I mean, so it's very hard to characterize the inheritance of that particular gene, or genes, I should say. Now, the good news is still with the VIP3A, and here's our screening data with VIP3AA39. In Texas, everything's coming back as susceptible to the VIP3AA39, and it's the same story in the Mid-South. And in fact, I mean, usually we pick up negative values to VIP3AA39 or the other VIP toxins. So, I mean, this year tends to be a little bit different in that we see positive numbers. And here's some data out of Mississippi. A lot of this is Nathan Little's, and some of his are testing with the negative values. The one I'd really point out is there's the one right under the second set of black bars. That was collected out of Leprechaun in Mississippi, and it tended to test a little bit higher. If you compare it to the Benzon strain, it tested 3.2-fold resistance, but that Benzon strain tends to be a little bit more tolerant than our other susceptible strain. So if you compare it back to our other susceptible strain, it turns out to be about 13-fold. And so this is kind of what we're seeing, and we've seen these larvae coming through some of the BT corn, particularly it's the leprechaun. We really haven't seen it in the Tricepta, but we picked this up in 2018, and then in 2019, almost every leprechaun plot I looked at this last year had larvae in it, and some of them are quite large. So there's something going on. But I think it's going to be a little bit different from what Dr. Yang is going to talk to you about in the talk following mine. So if we look at how these have changed over time, and of course 2016, not a large sample, but it does seem to be holding pretty steady. By and large, we're running 90 to 95% resistance to Cry1AC, and then about 70 to 75% to Cry2AB2, 100% to Cry1F. We're not picking up anything right now to VIP3A as far as from our field surveys. We're picking things up, but we're using different techniques to find them. Quickly, I'm going to go through some field performance data, and this is data that we do every year with the Mid-South group and me in Texas, where we take the different technologies and we spray them. We'll split the plot and we'll spray it. We're kind of looking at the benefit from treating for bollworms on different technology. And I'm not going to show all the states, and I'll tell you, this was just a terrible year for collecting this kind of data, because a lot of areas didn't have good bollworm pressure, and we had rain, constant rain, which tended to affect a lot of the outcomes as well. At College Station, we actually had a really good infestation, but most of it came right before bloom, and then so very early bloom. And you can see some differences among the technologies, but by and large, at this really early stage, most of the technologies other than Wide Strike, and I put Wide Strike in our trial, tended to be holding up pretty good. And the Wide Strike 3, Twin Link Plus, Bogart 2, Bogart 3, those are the others in the test. And then when we look at the yield, we're comparing the sprayed versus the non-sprayed, and really you need to look at within a technology. I didn't see any yield response, not even in the non-BT, and that's because the infestation came so early, you know, just right at first bloom or even before. Now we look at this, a little bit better location for looking at this is in Arkansas, Gus Syringa's trial, and his got non-BT Wide Strike 3, Twin Link Plus, Bogart 2, and Bogart 3. And you can see as far as seasonal average damage squares and bowls, you know, benefit from all the technologies, but he does show some significant differences, a lot less damage in Wide Strike 3 and the Twin Link Plus in this particular trial. Bogart 3 actually did not differ from the Bogart 2. And when he saw, but again, similar to what we had, and I think a lot of theirs was weather related, you can see what looks like usually a benefit from spraying, but it just wasn't statistically different in the test. Then looking at Jeff Gore's data, same technologies, very nice split as far as he got the non-BT being more heavily damaged than Bogart 2, and then your VIP technologies having less damage than the two gene. And looking at his yields, he saw a significant benefit from treating the non-BT, and actually from the Bogart 2, No benefit statistically from treating Wide Strike 3 or a Bogart 3. Lastly, Jackson, Tennessee, all the technologies seem to be producing similar results compared to the non-BT at Scott Stewart's location. But he did see some significant differences in yield from spraying. With the non-BT actually saw a difference with the Wide Strike 3, the Twin Link Plus, the Bogart 2, but some of those, like the Bogart 2 and the Bogart 3, actually the untreated ended up yielding more than the treated. So it was not a good year for these tests. I'm going to just go run through what we've seen throughout the year so you can see what we're doing. So this is we're looking at box and whisker plots of the technologies relative to a non-BT. So what this does kind of gives you an idea of efficacy of the product across a lot of locations. We want to hit that green line, and you can see here, you can see the Wide Strike 3 bumping it, Twin Link, Bogart 2, of course the Wide Strike well below it. Now we're looking at differences in yield from spraying, and again we want to be close to zero in this one as much as possible. And Bogart 2, it actually hit the mark across all locations here. In 2018, similar, you'll see overall the dual gene technologies aren't measuring up. And what this tells you is that under high pressure, that's when you'll see the problems. You know, if you don't have the pressure, you know, 80% control is probably going to be sufficient. 2018, again, now here we're looking at the differences in yield. And I know I'm running out of time, so I'm going through this really quick. And then from 2019, and again, this was a bad year, you can see the only one that didn't touch the mark was our dual gene on damage. And then the yields were all over the board this year, mostly due to weather, and actually we saw no differences. And with that, I appreciate your attention. I think I'm running out of time.
Thanks, David.
Mm-hmm.